Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, coronavirus brings the country to a standstill. Statewide school closures, public gatherings canceled, even Broadway shuts down. As drastic measures are taken to keep COVID-19 from spreading, average Americans are waking up to a new reality this week. And in Washington, the White House scrambles to contain the outbreak, from ramping up testing capacity to dealing with the economic fallout. Susan Glasser is a staff writer for The New Yorker, where she writes a weekly column on life in Trump's Washington. I spoke with her by Skype Friday morning. Hey, Susan.
Hi, Diane. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
Well, you know, we're just hunkering down here.
Well, I think that's a good thing for you to do. As soon as we record, I am going back home, and I'm going to stay there.
Well, good. You need to stay. Stay safe.
Susan Glasser, this has been a week I think Americans will not forget. And with all the closures in cities around the country, with sports cancellations, with school cancellations, Broadway shut down, can you tell me why the U.S. has been so slow in responding to the coronavirus?
Well, Diane, thank you so much for having me. It's great to talk with you. As I sit here looking out from my house at an uncannily empty road on a weekday, you know, it was eerie around Washington this morning, more so even than the previous days. And, you know, the unreality extends to, I think, a growing sense of disbelief among Americans at the failure of our government to take this seriously enough, quickly enough. And again, you know, you and I are not public health experts, but we understand when our system lights are blinking red. And for the last, you know, really couple of weeks, what we've seen, I think, is that the system lights among America's leading public health experts blinking red, freaking out, saying, listen, you know, the government is not responding the way that it is supposed to. And the numbers that came out this week, Diane, on the numbers of Americans tested just are shocking. There's no other way to explain it. They're shocking.
And what we seem to hear in the way of, quote, reassurance from our president seems somewhat shocking to me.
Well, that's right. I think that that Oval Office address that he gave a couple nights ago was really something that we will long remember as a moment when it was just painfully clear that the commander-in-chief was not equal to the moment. That was, you know, what I wrote in The New Yorker. And I just, the country was shutting down, and you had this self-congratulatory, fact-denying, garbled speech that immediately needed to be corrected, even in terms of what measures the president was taking. It was a painful moment for the country. And I truly believe that any previous president of my lifetime, Republican or Democrat, would have known what was the right kind of address to a worried nation.
Now, I gather what he did was to step away from what had actually been written and ad lib, which is where he got into so many mistakes.
Well, that's right. There's a Wall Street Journal piece that just came out now that says that there were some mistakes in the original text because they were keeping it close hold and writing up until the very last minute, and then additional mistakes inserted by the president. In both ways, of course, it shows the system breakdown starts in the White House and it radiates outward through the government from there. And, you know, this is anyone really surprised after 3 years of this dysfunction? I looked last week, before this latest turnover, before Trump, by the way, fired his latest White House chief of staff, and Brookings was already saying there was 82% turnover in the highest levels of the Trump White House and administration since the beginning of his administration. And, you know, they don't have a functioning White House. They have something that's much more like a court setup in which people don't have a real meaningful policy process anymore. They're set up to serve the leader. Close hold information, failure to follow best practices. They fired the experts at the National Security Council whose job it was to focus on preparedness for a global pandemic. So again, it's all those catastrophic decisions that were made over the course of the last few years in a crisis. You know, the cliche is correct. You go to war with the army that you have. Well, we're now all seeing the consequences of how Trump has been governing.
And of course, there were warnings about this that appeared late in January. And still, the administration did not take necessary steps.
Well, Diane, I think that as we reconstruct this, somebody said maybe there will end up being a, you know, kind of 9/11 commission style investigation of this. Obviously, we're still in the crisis, so it's too early to be looking back yet. And of course, we don't have the full facts. But one thing leapt out to me this morning I saw was that it was almost a week, I believe, before the National Security Council convened the first crisis meeting around the coronavirus in January. Again, it suggests that our system isn't working right, that all of the years of getting ready for this, you know, were significantly affected by decisions made by Trump about how to run or not run the government. The testing decision, obviously, and the lack of distributing tests widely, the crucial delay when the CDC's test didn't work, those are the things that strike me as affecting where we're at right now. You'll see, it sounds like the government really ramping up and individual states and localities and hospitals really stepping up the testing over the next week or so. And of course, then we'll start to see just how widespread this is. Right now, we have misleading information, and we all know bad information in, bad decisions come out as a result of that. We're making decisions as a country right now without having the real information about how widespread this is or isn't.
So how did his speech in the Oval Office affect people's thinking and the behavior of the markets the next day?
Well, that is fascinating, isn't it? You know, literally, you know, you could see the futures market, the Dow futures market, falling every word that the president uttered in that speech. You know, on the one hand, to me, observing Trump, it wasn't surprising in the sense that it was very consistent with how he's acted anytime he's been had his back against the wall in this presidency. But the world is still looking for leadership from the president of the United States. And certainly the American people are looking for leadership from the president. And so there is a connection as the markets realized, number one, that he was taking a pretty dramatic step in regards to Europe and doing something that's never been done before in terms of a travel. It's not 100% travel shutdown, it looks like, but a very, very significant one. And this is our biggest trading partner, our biggest ally. By the way, he didn't inform the Europeans, even give them a courtesy heads up. And that to me was remarkable and perhaps has increased the short-term economic hit from it, right? Because it's such a blow to global commerce to have that announced with no preparation at all.
You know, the one hero who comes out of this whole process seems to be Dr. Anthony Fauci, who, no matter what the White House says, continues to stick to the facts, to the scientific facts, rather than the political facts.
Well, that's right. At this kind of a moment, you see how expertise, government expertise, he is a government scientist. He is not just a private citizen. And, you know, we've seen a sustained assault on science, on expertise, on institutions like the National Institutes of Health, like the CDC, both of which have seen their budgets dramatically cut in the last few years. And who knows how this will shake out, but, you know, I would hope that this would be a reminder across partisan divides how important it is to still have a commonly agreed upon set of facts. And by the way, to be humble enough to say that we don't know the things that we don't know. That's the only way, you know, society is going to move forward, is if we stop lying to ourselves and believing it, which frankly is to me the essence of the Flim Flam Act we've been subjected to in the last few years, is lying to ourselves and believing it, at least some percentage of our population.
Tell me about the plan that Nancy Pelosi is trying to put together in the Congress.
Well, it's interesting. This in any previous moment, of course, in our history, really, you would imagine there would be a very bipartisan coming together and, you know, both parties agreeing upon what short term, at least, relief measures need to be taken. You know, she does appear, and I think a good sign for the country, to be negotiating actively with Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, although Trump himself and the Republican leaders in Congress have been more recalcitrant. But it does appear that Pelosi is set to announce a deal to institute free testing for the coronavirus, maybe 2 weeks of paid sick leave, up to 3 months of paid family leave, more unemployment benefits, school lunches, things like that. You know, you still have to deal with the Republican Senate, which does not have legislation of its own yet. So, you know, it doesn't mean that this is passed by any means, but the Republicans bowing to pressure from their vulnerable members just yesterday on Thursday announced that they were canceling their recess. So they'll be in a position to act quickly on the legislation.
What about testing, Susan? The president had said during that speech, we've done a great job with testing. We'll continue to test. We have millions of tests. That was just not true. Now, Dr. Anthony Fauci, the very next day, testified that the whole testing situation was failing. So where are we now?
That's right, Diane. You know, you talk about expertise begins with telling the American people the facts straight as they are. Americans are hardy people. They could handle the idea that, okay, we were slow, but we're going to get our act together now, you know, and that does seem to be what the situation is. What we don't know is how actively that was a result of Trump making decisions that harmed the public health interest or not. We just don't know the answer to that yet. But clearly, and unequivocally, the numbers are disgraceful in terms of the amount of tests that the American people have had. We know that people do not have access to tests, people with symptoms. We know that the criteria are misleading or unhelpful. We know all of these things. Up until now, the question is, have we gotten the system moving quickly now? We are being assured by medical professionals, not by Trump, that more tests will be available soon. And of course, that means then that there will be a big spike in the numbers as people who probably already had this are now being confirmed to have it. So, you know, it's just a terrible situation. As I understand it, the issue with the delay in making testing more available is that unfortunately, we lose the chance to have taken measures that would have reduced the sharpness of the spike in the epidemic. It's to buy time for the hospitals to get ready for these patients. And we may have blown through some of that cushion.
Now, the question becomes whether Trump himself is going to be tested. He has said he's not been tested, has no plans to be tested. What's your reaction?
You know, Donald Trump, we don't know why he's refusing to even take a test. But ironically, you have a situation where political leaders around the world, including here in the United States, may, in the short term at least, be more vulnerable to coronavirus because they live lives that are very active, right? And they're interacting with large numbers of people. You have in Canada, the First Lady of Canada, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's wife, has tested positive, we learned today on Friday, for coronavirus as well. So Trudeau is going into a quarantine for 2 weeks and is turned over to an acting prime minister, Chrystia Freeland. So, you know, it's an unbelievable situation. But Trump, at least in the short term, until, you know, I assume he'll change his daily schedule and protocols. But in the short term, Trump and our political leaders in Congress are more vulnerable to coronavirus because they are in contact with so many people.
Do some people have greater access to testing because of their particular situation, whether they're wealthy, whether they have standing, whether they have certain positions? Are they more likely to be tested than the ordinary Joe on the street?
Well, Diane, it's a good question, and neither you nor I are public health experts, but we both know that there's dramatic inequality in this country. We can see that when they wanted to test every player on an NBA team, they were able to do it very quickly. That isn't necessarily a bad thing, but I do think that you can see already some political fallout that is quite likely as people begin to consider the problem set raised by this. You already see Democrats talking a lot more about things like, let's make sure that there is access to health care or unemployment benefits for hourly workers, whereas you see the president talking about a payroll tax cut, you know, but that would, a payroll tax obviously affects people who are only already on the payroll of a business. So you're going to see political implication like that. I think you're going to see politics talking a lot more about universal access to broadband Wi-Fi and how unequal that is right now. If all the school children of America have to stay at home for some temporary period and engage in distance learning, you know, that might jolt Americans to think more clearly and sharply about the access to broadband internet. What, maybe we'll start thinking more about why are so many of America's school children dependent on free or reduced rate school lunches for their basic nutrition, or the number of homeless children or children who don't have access to technology at home. I feel like those are the kinds of things that we might see resounding here in Washington as we contemplate the consequences of a national shutdown.
A quick break. More of my conversation with Susan Glasser when we come back. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker, where she writes a weekly column on life in Trump's Washington.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Now, here's the rest of my conversation with Susan Glasser. Susan, let's talk about the upcoming election in November. Certainly, Joe Biden, the Democratic presidential frontrunner, has addressed COVID. Now, what do you believe he can say? What can Bernie Sanders, his opponent, say that will make a difference with voters about this whole issue?
Well, rarely, really never in our lifetime have we seen the politics of a presidential campaign be so upended in such a short period of time. And, you know, 1 month ago, the Biden campaign was being written off and Bernie Sanders was the front runner and Trump was the unaccountable, unchecked leader after his impeachment acquittal in the Senate. And so, you know, it's just extraordinary to see. It does, in the short term, clearly what we're seeing, I think, is that this crisis casts into such sharp relief Trump's shortcomings as a leader in a crisis. And it plays, I think, to Biden's campaign theme all along. And you saw that yesterday in the very presidential speech that Biden gave, right? He had a backdrop of American flags. He looked like he was a sort of an alternate president, a president in waiting. He had convened his own coronavirus task force that included people like Ron Klain, who led the U.S. response to Ebola, and other experts. And, you know, it seemed as if he was offering an alternate reality in which there was an actual president who was acting in a very different way than Donald Trump. And I was really struck by that. You'll see almost a Rose Garden strategy from the challenger in some ways, perhaps, as we go forward into this uncharted territory. Mass rallies are out. The two candidates who preferred mass rallies as their campaigning technique were Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. So that certainly hurts them.
So what about the debate that's coming up between Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden without an audience present? What kind of difference do you think that could make?
Well, it's a very interesting situation, right? After two straight weeks of running the table, essentially, in the primaries in Super Tuesday and this week in states such as Michigan and elsewhere, you have a situation where Joe Biden is the strong leader in the Democratic race, but it's not over. And Bernie Sanders refused to step aside. He said he really wanted to continue his campaign and that he was going to participate in this debate, which would end up being the first one-on-one debate of the primary season. It doesn't appear that he has much of a mathematical path forward. Certainly the national polls continue to reflect Biden's consolidation of Democratic support. So one question is, how much would continuing the campaign and further dividing Democrats, will that play to Donald Trump's advantage? Or is it a situation where both sides are looking for a graceful way out and Bernie Sanders is looking for a way to make sure that his issues that he cares about are on the table? Things like healthcare obviously become very important to people in a crisis, and Sanders has made that the core of his campaign message.
Of course, in the middle of all this, you've got voters going to the polls on Tuesday in Arizona, Florida, Illinois, Ohio. Are they going to be hampered as they try to go to the polls because of the virus? Will it be a low turnout?
Well, that's a great question. I think that the challenge of running an election this year is one that clearly people are just beginning to wrap their minds around. You know, will you see more distance voting? Will you see more mail-in ballots, as Washington State is already very strongly in that direction? And they did just manage to have their primary last week. Interestingly enough, Democrats do seem engaged and energized, and the turnout has been going up relative to 2016 in the primaries. And that may reflect, you know, a party that is consolidating around the idea that defeating Trump is a top priority. It may reflect that you have more Republicans crossing lines in states where they have open primaries to vote. But the logistics of this are just a simple nightmare for politics, as they are for every other aspect of our society right now.
So you think that the primary that comes up this Tuesday, you think that voter turnout could still be great despite this virus?
We'll see, right, Diane? I don't know. We're in unprecedented territory.
Yeah.
But I will say this, it pretty much makes you feel at a time of national crisis that your vote matters, and that if you want to have a say in the government and you want to know who's going to be the commander in chief going forward, then you better find a way to participate.
You know, Susan, that's the big political question, whether Donald Trump is going to pay a political price for what's happened with this coronavirus. Early on, he was calling the virus a Democratic hoax. He was saying that it was nothing more than just the flu, and people get over the flu. Are his supporters going to remember those words, even as the cases of corona spike around the country?
Donald Trump has again and again and again escaped accountability for things that would have destroyed any other politician, just as he escaped accountability for things that would have destroyed any other businessman. And so one has to be very, very wary in predicting accountability for Donald Trump that so far has not happened in his career or in his personal life. And as you know, we have watched scandals erupt for the last few years and thought, well, surely this will change the polls and surely this will cause Republicans to desert him. And so far they haven't. There's a pretty solid core of around 40% of Americans who have continued to support Donald Trump no matter what he says or does. Now, their daily lives are being affected in a way that has never happened in either of our lifetimes. And so will they care more now that their daily lives are being disrupted, that their children can't go to school, that their workplaces are closed, that they can't get a test if they're feeling unwell or worried about someone that they love? Do they care if their parents or grandparents are put at risk of a disease that strikes them more? Obviously, viruses don't know party lines. And so the question is, can party lines continue to be used as the way in which Americans are interpreting the nature of this crisis? If it was anyone else, I'd say, well, of course, this is a debacle for someone who was being judged on standards of competence and decision making and reassuring the public, which is the old standards by which we judged our leaders.
Susan, in this crisis, to whom are you looking for leadership?
You know, Diane, that's such a good question, as the news has become overwhelming in recent years. In my view, we have better access than ever before to genuine expertise. But of course, we also are barraged with a lot of information that is dubious. I really have tried to pay close attention to a lot of doctors and public health experts who have gone out of their way to communicate with the public, whether it's on Twitter or on cable news or in the newspapers. I would say to people, get information from verified sources because there's more of it than ever before. You know, when the head of the School of Public Health at Harvard raises the alarm and says, we're making big mistakes, we're not doing what we need to do, I've never seen this level of incompetence, as the head of the Harvard School of Public Health said yesterday, I pay attention to that. Our system and the people whose job it is to understand, if their lights are blinking red, to me, that's who you should pay attention to and not listen to blowhards who are talking for political gain on one side or the other.
Before we close, is there anything else you'd like to say to our listeners?
You know, a few years ago, very beginning of the Trump administration, I had a long kind of exit interview with Lisa Monaco, who was a college classmate of mine, who was President Obama's top Homeland Security advisor. And I asked her at the end of the conversation, which was mostly about Russia and the Russian intervention in 2016, since you spent the last few years reading all of those intelligence reports and briefing President Obama on the world of scary threats, what keeps you up at night? What should we be worrying about that we're not talking about? I just reread this interview yesterday. This was in the spring of 2017. And she said, the thing that keeps me up at night is the possibility of a global pandemic. And my message to the Trump administration is, we've worked really hard over the last few years to put together plans that we didn't have before and to invest with our allies and partners in global health in a way that we didn't before. My message to them is, please, please keep this work going. And how tragic, Diane, you know, that was immediately cut by the Trump administration.
And how prescient she was.
Well, that's right. You know, I'm sure that Lisa right now is not feeling good about having been prescient, but I'm glad that our country has people like her and others who have spent a lot of time thinking about what we can do to respond to this. And I know that the country's strength is the fact that it is still a decentralized nation of brilliant people who are capable of coming together to meet challenges, even if the government screws up.
Susan, as always, thank you.
Diane, great to talk to you.
That's all for today. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsverka of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers this week are Cliff Gallagher and Natalie Urev-Lipker. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.